This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, a podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. For the last episode of the second series of Hospice Waikato's Last Breath, we're finishing as we began, with a special international guest. In this interview, BAFTA-winning filmmaker and journalist Kevin Tullis reflects on the traditional Irish wake as a living ritual through which communities can process grief together.
I've been struggling to think how to describe you. So I've been keeping abreast of your visit to New Zealand, and I've had a look at all your activities back home, and obviously you're writing and you're producing work, and you're a journalist. And so I've just come to the conclusion that like all journalists, you're a storyteller as well. Storyteller and a raconteur. And when it comes to the reason why you're here in New Zealand, the Irish death ritual, you've got a story there, and you've made it a compelling story, and you're going around the world, the Western world in particular, and telling us that we're doing death wrong. And that's the reason why Hospice started this podcast 3 years ago, because there was this feeling that in New Zealand, Pākehā New Zealand, we don't do death properly at all. It's clinical, it's shut away, and we hide ourselves from the realities of death. So am I correct in saying that's your story? You're teaching us a better way to do death?
Well, teaching is probably, too heavy a word. I suppose I am an ambassador from an old funereal rite. And I've actually come from like the far side of the world to talk about something that is just so common at every other day occurrence, which is dying and death. Now, the Irish have a social ritual revolving around the Irish wake, which makes conversation about death much more easier, because it makes it sort of familiar. It's like a little inoculation every day. The Irish, literally on the radio stations, the names of the dead are called out every day. My local radio station, County Mayo, Midwest, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 5 o'clock. The death has occurred of Nora Kilbane of Knocknacree, reposing in her residence, removal from her home on Thursday at 7 to such and such a church, or my favourite, Our Lady of the Universe. Mass of the resurrection the following day, and interment in the adjoining cemetery. Little pause, on with the next name. Paddy Devlin of Dukanella, Achill Island. So literally the names of the dead are kind of read out on the local public radio. People then go in great numbers to their neighbours' wakes, their funeral homes where there's a visitation. They go to the funerals, they go to the graveyards. Sometimes they even have a kind of death competition where they say, did you see 220 cars, my God, And some people even defensively go to funerals in order to make sure that people will go to their funerals and wakes. But it's just a much more common every other day sort of conversation occurrence. And it doesn't make the Irish, less afraid of dying, but it does make them less afraid of talking about dying and being able to walk up to someone who's grieving, shake their hands and say, I'm sorry for your troubles. It's just a more humane expression of what it is to be mortal.
Well, already I'm kind of astonished. That's an extraordinary story. And I'm thinking, gosh, I wish we had that kind of thing here in New Zealand, reading out the names of the recently deceased on the radio.
It's the most popular item on Midwest. And in the past, before the kind of internet, some Irish radio stations used to have like a kind of playback tape. And it cost you 95 cents a minute in case you'd missed any of the dearly departed. So you could kind of phone up. And they would like spit a tape of last week's or last yesterday's deaths, and it's known as the deaths, and all of these small little things, but they all add to making death terribly normal. I've seen Irish people almost like ambassadors and diplomats, asking how was it, or were they ill, or what happened then. I've seen 10-year-old boys go around like some Irish diplomats shaking the hands of the bereaved with great confidence. Because, of course, it's sort of like getting up in the morning. Has anyone died in Ireland? Yep. Is it raining somewhere in Ireland? Yep. It's just ordinary, commonplace.
Well, that story about the 10-year-old boys, it makes me think straight away that this ritual brings a cohesiveness into the community, knits people together.
Well, it's even more profound than that. You see, because in the Irish wake, what distinguishes an Irish wake, and it's very similar to a Maori tangi, there's a real dead body right in front of you. There's not a plastic model, there's not some symbolic thing. There's a real dead corpse that you can walk up to, you can touch, if you want, kiss, embrace, say a few prayers over. And what you'll find in a small Irish town on a Friday evening, you'll all see queues of people, 200, 300 people outside a funeral home, waiting to go in, to shake the hands of the bereaved and then, you know, pray over the corpse. It's quite common for people to touch the corpse, what you might call the ice cube touch, the ice cube feeler, ice cubes in a rubber glove. That's what it sort of feels like. But that moment of encounter between the living us and the dead them is the epicenter of our human civilization, because it has spawned our eternal quest for eternal life. And every prophet, religion, holy book, every male edict on the frailty of women, every temple, synagogue, mosque, every jar of face cream, you know, our desire not to be dead, sciences of medicine, the movie trade, and actually the murders of millions of other human beings, witches, pagans, heretics, the other, the enemy, barbarians, who fail to believe in our particular vision of a deathless heaven. And that is just comes from that kind of moment, whereas you're looking in at the corpse and it's a kind of mirror of who we shall all become. So it's obviously humbling, but it also is that whole lesson is we've in our civilization, you know, we don't want to be dead. And so some prophet turns out of nowhere and says, well, I know what, folks, I will lead you into the promised land of eternal life if you just follow these books. Now, I've got a lot of respect for religion, but it all stems from that moment of encounter. And we're kind of missing out if you don't have that moment of encounter yourself.
On that note, I'm thinking about these tech bros in Silicon Valley who are living these extraordinary lives surrounded by this extraordinary medical technology and their quest to live forever. And a few years ago, I got to interview a scientist whose whole world was trying to crack the genetic code for immortality. And he was doing everything he could to live longer. I found that curious.
Yeah.
When I started doing this podcast and I started sitting next to people who were dying and talking to them about their impending death, I started to find in myself a complete reevaluation of the way that I felt about life and the world. And I'm now really, really comfortable with the idea. And I think about it every day. I wake up every day and think, I'm 64. My death is going to be sooner than later.
Yep.
And when that time comes, I'm really, really hoping that I'm going to be very comfortable about it.
Sure.
And I look back to I look at these tech bros who are trying to live forever and this particular scientist, and I feel kind of sad.
All I can say, Andrew, is thank God for death, because if we didn't have death, then Stalin and Mao or their future equivalents, or possibly Donald Trump even today, they would live forever. They'd be like first in the queue. I've written quite a bit about this in this other book I've written called 9 Rules to Conquer Death. What these very clever tech bros who sort of want to extend their life fail to sort of realise is that our perception, the logic, the way that we interpret it in the world is actually based in our sort of mortality. So let's just say you could live for 10,000 years and you decided to play on the English Premier football team or join the All Blacks and just be a player in the All Blacks for like 1,000 years. Yeah, because you've got 10,000 years. Or why study just one degree at university? Why not go to Cambridge or Oxford and take every single course? So, well, I mean, it would only take you maybe 3,000 years. I mean, all of these things, everything begins to unravel. Children, you know, growing. Do these new semi-immortal children, do they take 4,000 years from conception through to adulthood? What does this mean? And it kind of sounds attractive. Maybe they're talking like about, you know, 120 years. The other thing that happens, of course, is that mortality doesn't come alone. You know, as we grow older, we have various ailments, arthritis, you know, leaky heart valves, etc. So what does it mean, this notion of a sort of semi-immortality or extending the... It sounds simple, but when you begin to think of it, it begins to unravel. We sort of judge mortalities in almost every single sentence that we think about. I'm only in my 20s. You say, oh my God, look at him. Jesus, he's never going to settle down. He's in his early 30s now. Can't that guy get a job? Or women often have this thing about the biological clock, your life is settling down. You know, there's, you want to kind of play the field in your 20s, but sort of get serious and settle down in your 30s and 40s and then have children. And then the notion of having, you know, are these tech bros going to have their first child at 100? All of it is, it's a contradiction to the mortal logic by which we run our societies and lives, the internal clock that's actually inside our head. And of course, the worst of it is death is that great, you know, liberation. You know, all these great dictators, pharaohs, kings will fall. Once you take away that ultimate sanction, I'm not so sure of the prospects for the rest of us.
I've often looked at Rupert Murdoch, who's now well into his 90s, and I've thought, death is a great cleansing.
Yeah.
It clears the way for a new generation.
Yep, another TV series.
And if we don't have that cleansing, we stratify.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the danger, I guess.
Yeah, yep.
Now, Kevin, as I said, I've listened to everything you've been doing here in New Zealand. So I thought, what am I going to do to make it interesting for you? It's something a little bit different. So last night on my Facebook page, I transcribed your recent Radio New Zealand appearance, and I took some quotes from that transcription and put them on my Facebook page. And I said, I'm talking to you today, and is there anything you would like me to ask Kevin? I wasn't expecting much. I was a bit astonished when I opened my Facebook this morning. It was just inundated with people who had questions for you or wanted to share experiences.
Sure.
But this is also very interesting. As I've been doing the second series of The Last Breath, I decided to just talk to people focusing on people who are dying or people who are recently bereaved and people who work in palliative care. And I thought, this time I'm just going to talk to people I bump into and ask them about death. And I thought, yeah, I'd do one-hour episode, maybe made up of 10-minute clips of people saying what they think about death and grief and their experiences of grief and assisted dying and all that kind of thing. I was really astonished that nobody I sat down with spoke for less than an hour.
Okay.
And their response in every single case was, you know, I really want to talk about these things. I really need to talk about these things, but my friends won't have a bar of it. We're at dinner parties. People want to talk about the weather and sport, but they don't want to talk about these things that are really important to me. And so I've learned that people want to have this discussion. They really want to talk about death, and they really want to get down to the nitty-gritty and talk about detail, but they don't often get that opportunity. And I think that's partly to do with our culture in New Zealand. But I can't say that as our entire culture, because, of course, Māori have a very different perspective. And that's one of the questions was, do you see a similarity between Māori spirituality and Irish spirituality in regards to death?
Well, clearly in the tangi and the Irish wake, you have a great sort of parallels. I mean, I've not been to tangi. I've not even been to Marae myself. I've been moving around. So you must forgive me for my ignorance. But obviously, from what I understand, obviously you have the presence of the body. You have the kind of communal gathering around. You have speeches. You have this acknowledgement around the dying and death of this individual. And that is very similar to like the Irish wake. One of the things that the Irish do is they're under social obligation to sort of chase you down the supermarket aisle, you know, after a bereavement and shake your hands to acknowledge the death. So it's the opposite of the kind of what I would call the Western death machine, where we're afraid of the bereaved. We're afraid of the dying. We don't want to contact them. We're embarrassed. We think that sad is bad. So that if I see you in the supermarket, let's say a month after you've lost your mother, I kind of avoid you because if I have to go up to you, you burst into tears and that'd be just absolutely terrible. And sad is bad. So in that sense, I think there are incredibly strong parallels between the Irish wake and Māori tangi. It is incredibly interesting that these two cultures, as far away on the planet from each other, have huge, you know, common historical parallels between them. And I'd say that's probably because that's what people, human societies, have been doing, you know, from Neolithic times onwards. On Achill Island, where my family are from, there are Neolithic tombs on the same mountain where we bury our own dead. So the people have been burying their dead on that hillside for 6,000 years. And these Neolithic tombs are like huge capstones that are like 30 tons, that these, you know, Stone Age people or Stone Age tools are just as intelligent as us, but must have carried, and, you know, they built a structure. And they built a structure because the dead and the funereal rituals around the dead meant something to them, were important to them. And that, again, is the sort of, this is the huge commonplace, I think, between the Irish wake and the Maori tangi, that the loss of someone, their dying, the rites that you have to do to lay them to rest, these are socially significant events and rituals that have to be marked by the gathering of the community together. It, you know, it's a sort of humane way of easing out the passage of another human being, but also of comforting the bereaved. And at the bottom of it all, it's also a fertility rite, because just as we have lost a brother and sister today, so too from the pulsating wombs of the lamenting living will newborn sons and daughters spring. It's an assertion of the power of the community over the death of one individual.
Okay, that's provoked a whole lot of questions to me. And you had a nerve, because well, I've heard a lot, this a lot during the last breath, people saying, I'm afraid I see somebody in the supermarket. Oh, should I go up to them or not? There's hesitation and a fear. I don't have that fear, but my fear is I don't want to say, oh, I'm so sorry for your loss. I don't want to offer a euphemism. I just want to go up and make an acknowledgement. And I often think that I hope I'm not being misunderstood because I don't mention the death. I just want to go up and say, hi, how are you? Just be nice and just move on. And some part of me says, well, that's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, in the Iliad, I often cite it as an example. In the Iliad, man slaying Achilles, the main Greek champion. This is obviously the great poem about the fall of the city of Troy, written by Homer in 750 BC. But in the Iliad, there's an episode where the Greek champion, Achilles, has lost his lover Patroclus. And he takes Patroclus' body back to the Greek camp. And he has his warriors, the Myrmidons, sort of ride round on their horses, round Patroclus' body. And they're all keen and wail. And Homer says that they do this until the breastplates of the warriors are wet with tears. And Achilles then says, we shall have our fill of the pleasures of sorrow. So he's like manslaying Achilles is sort of, you know, it's like Rambo. But nevertheless, it's okay for warriors to keen, to show their grief, to scream out loud. One other little bit of advice is from his mother, say, and don't forget to have more sex as a form of grief therapy. Yeah, but it's okay to have the pleasures of sorrow. That's what this ancient Greek poem is saying. It's okay to recognize loss. Don't be frightened of, you know, tearing up, of grief, of crying out loud. It's part of what it is to be human. And what we've done is absolutely the opposite. We think, oh my God, anything that you say, if it's sad and it makes people upset, that's a terrible thing. But the Greeks and Homer are saying, it's actually okay to be sad. Sad is good, because that's what it is to be human. Not forever, but obviously through this period. And that's, you know, what keening, equivalent of crying out the tangi, but also keening in the Irish wake. We're all, you know, the women cry, it affects people, it makes me cry. And you're showing that, you know what, this is someone that we loved, someone important in our life, and we've lost them, and we're sad. And it's absolutely okay to be sad.
How did we get to this point in New Zealand where we're afraid to say something, when we leave it to undertakers to take care of everything, where it's all one step removed? How did we get to this point? Why did we get to this point?
So it begins really with a long, complicated process, some of which is part of medical health, you know, public sanitation. The first sanitarium, which is to isolate TB, you know, if we were walking around in the 19th century, 1 in 4 of the population would be dying of TB. You're walking through a city like London, people would be coughing, spluttering, you know, the air would be full of infection. The River Thames was just a kind of open sewer. Churchyards would be actually crammed full of the stinking dead. There was one Baptist minister on the Strand in 1839, you know, just next to the current Royal Courts of Justice. He opened up a Baptist chapel, and within 10 years he managed to get 12,000 bodies underneath the actual, the base of the church, which you could imagine the smell of the dead and the prayers of resurrection must have risen to heaven, you know, together. So obviously we've had a whole public sanitation, sewers, some of which is, you know, very positive. But what we've also done is that we've subcontracted our mortality out to sort of hospitals, to bereavement counsellors, to undertakers, to the medical profession. Even within the medical profession, some doctors subcontract mortality out to palliative care doctors. And also we regard palliative care as a foreign land that we only go to at the end of our own lives. So what we've done is we've, by in all of this process, we've kind of reduced the social space, the social conversation. We somehow think if somebody dies instantly, you know, they're infectious, therefore we need an undertaker. There's nothing wrong with being an undertaker. But, you know, undertakers can be part of a big capitalist machine. You know, it's, the individual is just an employee. In the UK, 60% of the death trade is controlled by two particular entities, the co-op and another hedge fund called Dignity, which is some sort of hedge fund. You know, if you go to along to an English street, you'll see an undertaker, you know, shop window, but that could probably be owned by Dignity. It's just a shop front. And, you know, they might say, well, to the manager, well, what's your yield, Andrew? I mean, how much yield are you getting per unit? And obviously, it's how much money you're extracting out of the family. So they control the death process. It is this sort of social space. And so, for instance, so it's very difficult to get buried in the UK. And it's also very difficult to get cremated quite quickly. So it's very difficult then to have a wake. I mean, we can't have Uncle Johnny hanging around in the house for 6 weeks. So we have to put him into the care of the undertaker, which costs. And we can't have a wake. And then people say, well, you have to be embalmed, you know. But if you could have a wake, you know, which is so-and-so dies, the wake begins, there's two nights of remembrance, memorial, a lot of laughter. You have two nights and then you bury them. So maybe they die on the Friday and you bury them on the Monday. Here's a good counterexample. Dublin is a 1,000-year-old city. It was founded by the Vikings. People have been buried in Dublin for the last 1,000 years. You can still get buried in Dublin in 3 days. If you do die on the Friday, you'll be in the ground by Monday or Tuesday with the aid of Dublin undertakers. So it's not that it's not possible to do this in advanced societies. If they can do it in Dublin, you can do it anywhere in the world. It's the way that the kind of capitalist death machine works to actually actively prevent this in order to maximise the returns on the capital that they have employed in terms of staff, cars, crematoriums, slots. It's all about what's ultimately in their commercial interests rather than the psychological interests of the bereaved.
So death has become a commercial business.
Well, it always was a bit of a commercial business. Just, you know, birth is a commercial business. Everything is a bit of a... And that's absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But what's happened is it's turned too much in the favour of the kind of these corporate interests and not enough in favour of the needs, the emotional needs of the family, of the bereaved.
Well, one of the things I've learnt during the course of this series is that in New Zealand, you don't have to use an undertaker. You don't have to be embalmed. You don't have to pay any money at all. You can bring the body home. Body doesn't need to leave the home. You can have your wake very quickly, and then you can bury the body yourself.
See, what's interesting is that the way that you're saying that is that we sort of think that they, you know, we're reacting against these regulations, but these regulations have never existed. That it becomes a sort of cultural prison. Think, well, we have to call on help, we have to do this. And certainly, for instance, if one of your relatives died in hospital, I would think even in New Zealand, even with, you know, it would be kind of like tricky just to sort of turn up with a ute and shove them in the back. You know, there'd be like forms to fill and people say, well, need this. You know, there are organisations, you know, Death Without Debt. There's lots of sort of communitarian organisations that are obviously trying to reclaim this death, natural burial grounds. I wrote once that if your DNA, shared DNA, love, let's say what happened with my mother died of a heart attack, 64 in Edinburgh on a sofa one day, just in the middle of, you know, nothing special. The ambulance crew who came to futilely give her CPR, which they had to do, that was part of their job, even though that they knew that she was dead. And my father told them that he was dead because he was very familiar with dead people. But they had to do that, and I have absolutely no objection. That was exactly the right thing to do, even though they knew she was dead. But they also then hijacked her body. They slung her in at the back of the ambulance and took her off for a compulsory post-mortem. And we had to sort of negotiate then for the return of our mother. And it took about 5 days. And obviously you had to have an undertaker and a release form, and the death had to be investigated. Now, it could have been that after 40 years of marriage and a fairly undisturbed sofa, you know, sitting room that my father had, you know, she could have been a potential victim of some sort of homicide. It probably didn't look that way, but that's what happened anyway. And my mother ended up, obviously there was PM, she had a heart attack. It was one of the 8,000 coronary fatalities amongst women in Scotland that year, as opposed to one of the 80 women who were murdered. But she got exactly the same sort of procedure. The state took control of her body. You know, that was it. And if they wanted to, you know, because she could still be on a slab. And the morgue, you don't have any power. Now, some of that we think is good because, you know, we don't want people to be murdered without it being ever investigated. But percentage terms, in reality, is such a sort of tiny percentage. But it was an example of the power of the state to decide what to do with our mother's body. Now, she was our mother. We loved her. It was our shared DNA. My father loved her very much. And so he was obviously shocked and grieving. But then we were also sort of shocked and grieving. We didn't have a locus. You know, eventually we kind of got her back, you know, to the funeral parlour. But it showed you the kind of power of the state to reach into this very ordinary death and show who's boss. And you did. So that's part of the kind of Western death machine, is that they can, if they wanted to, these authorities could absolutely take sort of control. There wasn't a sort of evil genius. There wasn't, aha, I'm going to get the Tullis family and I'm going to show it to them. But it was the way that the machine can work. And it's an example. Often that people feel that, a relative's died in the hospital. What do we do? And they sort of think the machine, just go along with the machine. But the machine is there for its own purposes rather than for your own psychological needs.
And it's inflexible.
It's pretty inflexible. You're a kind of digit in the machine. You're being processed. This machine goes from, you know, the hospital mortuary, how do we release the bodies, to where you're going to get buried, what's going to happen, how are the institutions. And these, essentially, unless the community has control of this process of dying to burial or cremation will be colonized by other institutions, sometimes for their own purpose and sometimes for their own profit.
You know, I forgot to ask you the most important question was, how did you become so immersed in the subject of death? But before we do that, I want to tell you about Viona. She left a message on my social media. She read the quotes that I, your quotes, and she said, when my mother died, my father turned up at home with her body and put her on display. And she said, I'd never seen such a thing. And he said, well, it's my fault because I haven't reminded you enough that we're Irish descent. And he said, we're going to have a proper Irish funeral. And he said, I'm taking the control of my wife's body away from the undertaker. I don't want her lying on a cold slab. Mm-hmm. I want her in the warmth of the home. And Viona said that was the very first time she'd been to Tangi, but yeah, she'd never been into a Pākehā house where this had happened before. And she said it was an extraordinary experience because Mum was there in the living room for 3 days. And she said perhaps the most interesting thing was the children. She said the kids came in, and the first thing that happened was Nana hasn't got her glasses on. She doesn't look like Nana, so glasses were put on. Mm-hmm. And then all Nana's favourite things were picked up from around the house and put in the coffin. And there was lots of playing. There was lots of games going on underneath the coffin. It was on a stand. And she said the kids were just so totally relaxed. And she said it was a revelation to her. But she said, I was she said, I saw my father through different eyes at that point. And she said, it was a revelation. I was so grateful to him. And when he died, I made sure that he had exactly the same send-off.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, with my old father, Sonny, we had lots of children playing. My nephew, Sean, who was 9 at the time, would run into the sitting room, stick his fingers through Sonny's hair. Sonny had like great, thick, wonderful hair, better hair than I have now, and then sort of run on. And I'm sure later on that night, those children, they were the kind of the children of nieces and nephews, cousins. You know, they went home, they watched Teletubbies, they had beans on toast. You know, life went on. And the tangy and obviously the wake, a bit like an inoculation, is that you have to do a little bit along the whole course of life. You know, probably your first one is not, it's like an old person, or it might be your grandmother stuff. But you're sort of educating these children. This is what happens. Death happens. It's an every other day occurrence. And then we go on with life. You know, that's what happens. We die in each other's, we live on in each other's death and die in each other's lives. This is part of the pattern of what it is to be sort of human. And so this sort of death talk, I'd say, is a bit like a foreign language. The sooner you start learning, the better. Just as we say with like foreign language, you start learning French when you're 3 or 4, you know, it's a lot better than trying to do it at 65. Yeah.
So how did you get immersed in this subject, Kevin? What was the trigger for you?
So the trigger for me was I was 20, and even though I had grown up in a wake culture, you know, I'd gone to wakes when I was a child on the island, but my brother Bernard died. He was 28. He died of chronic myeloid leukemia. That was his bone marrow transplant, and I was 20. And despite all this, enabling and background of the Irish way of death, it was a huge existential shock. I mean, it was, I was a narcissistic, self-centered 20-year-old, pretty much like every other narcissistic, self-centered 20-year-old, who obviously thought it was sort of more immortal. And I kind of thought my brother was sort of like akin to, you know, he's having difficulty with his university exams, and he would reset them, and he would sort of, you know, get through it. And that old guy would run up the ward, you know, in a white coat with some sort of miracle drug. And I know that it sounds stupid and childish, but that's what I kind of thought. You know, I just somehow, the notion that on one level I knew that he was very, very seriously ill, and I knew that he could die. But on another level, I had this, it's like magical thinking. That's what it was magical thinking. So when he did die, several things occurred, but basically I began to grieve. And I kind of selfishly, I didn't grieve for my dead brother. I grieved for the 20-year-old man who had lost his mortal innocence. I grieved for me. Suddenly I realized I was a mortal survivor alone in the world. There were odd incidents where it was just after my brother died, and we were back at the house, and someone was saying, we need to get an undertaker. And it was those old-fashioned days when it was a fixed phone, and there were telephone directories in the hall, and the door to the sitting room was closed. And I took on the task of finding an undertaker, which it was akin to feeling like, where's the local neighbourhood nuclear physicist? I mean, it was like all of this was happening within literally minutes, less than 2 hours of my brother dying. And I was sort of scrambling through the old yellow pages, and someone shouted out, oh, it's Marino or Maren, or I don't think we'd ever had a death in the family. We were Irish immigrants to Edinburgh. But someone said, you know, it sounded like ice cream, because there were a lot of Italian immigrants who ran ice cream parlours. And anyway, I remember finding this name, the yellow pages, and I phoned up the number. And this guy, he had this really deep, reassuring voice. like the coachman in all the vampire movies. And he was very sort of calm, and I was sort of shaken. And he said, "Well, you know, give us some details and whatever." And he said, "And who should we liaise with in the family?" And I remember looking around that hallway. I was just alone in the hallways, 20 or just the cusp. I was on the cusp between 20. Maybe I was 19. And I remember saying, "Me." And weirdly, it was like a kind of anointment. It was like an act of this man who I never met actually in life made me a man, because I was no longer a child. By saying me, I was taking the responsibility for this death, this liaison, but I was also taking the responsibility as a mortal survivor, that I could never be free of the knowledge of death again until my own dying days. And that I would also have responsibility for other mortal survivors, children, partners, my parents. This weird phone call, this Edinburgh undertaker made me a man.
Magical thinking. I was 11 when my sister was killed, and...
I'm sorry to hear that, Andrew.
Thank you, Kevin. And I remember... Again, it never leaves you. It never leaves you. And I remember...
How did your sister die?
Run over by the school bus.
Okay, yeah.
And I can remember sitting in that church. We're only 10 months apart, so we're quite close. I can remember sitting in the church, in our local Catholic church, looking at her coffin and thinking, well, this isn't real, and any minute now she's just going to step out and we're just going to go back to the way things were. And I believed that even after she was in the ground. I was just waiting for that moment when she was going to step out of that coffin. It didn't happen.
So one of the things about the Irish wake, which is very useful, and that is to do with what sounds like a cliche of all these people shaking your hands and saying, "I'm sorry for your trouble, sorry for your trouble." And actually, Irish undertakers, who are perfectly, it's a perfectly honourable profession, I don't want to be down on undertakers, but they will advise you to actually take off your wedding rings, because your hand is going to be so bruised. And even people who turn up at the funeral, it's not just they don't just turn up at the funeral to sort of be in the crowd. They're under this sort of social protocol to actually physically shake your hand. But what they're also doing in that, you know, 400, 500 is not uncommon. And then it could go on for months afterwards as people encounter you in social situations who were away or couldn't make the funeral. There's a kind of like a little hidden message where they're actually saying, you know, they're dead. I know they're dead. You know, the physical, it's like a muscle memory. You can feel it. You can actually feel the pain in your hand afterwards, having been shaken by so many people. Or you remember slithery handshakes and bone-shaking handshakes. But what it is actually is kind of almost like physiologically imprinting. They're dead and they're not coming back, you know. Now, can it completely get rid of magical thinking? No. But it's that the whole community has acknowledged this openly, and they've also physically imprinted it on your hand. So that is a way of short-circuiting magical thinking. But of course, the grief reaction that you're describing with your sister is incredibly common. My own sister-in-law, Bernard's wife, had the same thing. So if, once we get through the fuss of the funeral, everything's going to start again. Or there's also the American writer Joan Didion, and she has literally that book called A Year of Magical Thinking, where she's looking at her dead husband John's shoes in the wardrobe 5 months after he's dead, and she just can't throw them out. She can't deal with it because, of course, he might need them again. Obviously, he's never coming back, and he's not going to need those shoes.
It's quite a barrier to get over, isn't it?
Again, I think that's what happens in a wake and with a tangi, presumably, is that because you have much more social a gathering, you're standing there in the middle of this community who are all acknowledging this loss, actively acknowledging this loss by being there, giving of themselves as living presence, it is a way, it's like a form of kind of catharsis in which you try and bring on that grief, expel that grief, bring in this new existential understanding. Does it work? Absolutely no, but it's a lot better than the sort of silence and shunning and denial by not acknowledging that this person is gone and that you've lost someone you loved.
One of the people I interviewed in the second series was Paul Turney, and he lost his brother about the same time that I lost my sister. And he talked about that experience, which was very akin to my own. He said, we were simply told he was dead, right, and not another word was said. And he said, he's almost 70 now, and he said, looking back, he said, there was no resolution. He said there was a formal funeral, I didn't see the body, and then he was buried, and it was never spoken of. And he said there was no counselling, there was no offers of help, what can I do for you? He said, I was a 17-year-old boy left to do it on my own. And he said, it took me 25 years to get past it. Rather sad, isn't it?
One of the problems about the rise in the UK, and presumably it's happening here too, in what we call direct cremations. So, you know, you die in hospital and then your body's shipped all around the country in the UK to the kind of cheapest crematorium and the cheapest kind of van hire, and the ashes are then sort of sent back to you 2 weeks later in a kind of DHL bag. Is that you're not, the psychological process of sort of death, dying, funeral, bereavement, etc., it's just foreshortened so that you disappear. You don't really die, you disappear. You know, you're there and then you're completely gone. And that obviously can be very traumatic about grief, because the people who you've left behind don't have a locus. They don't have a way of sort of expressing their emotion. And that is the sort of the danger of the Western death machine, is that it shrivels. I suppose one thing I'd like to really talk about is that we're actually too afraid of dying in the Western death machine. We have a kind of way where it's like we are it's the sun that is the center of the universe, and that when the sun goes out, you know, that will be absolute oblivion, obviously the oblivion of that particular person. But we also, there's another notion where we're not really like the sun. We're actually just planets, really. We can conceive of that. We're planets that revolve around each other. New planets, maybe moons, you know, are created, children, and they revolve around, and then they go off on their own track. And we're all kind of involved in it. And it's almost like that's what we need to replace this idea of this overwhelming, terrible, you know, cataclysmic oblivion of the loss of me. We're all part of this great mortal us. We play a part. There's a natural span here. It's this kind of overwhelming fear, whereas I think if you sort of think of it like you're a planet, I mean, you know, and it's the nature of these planets to sort of rise, fall, be involved with others. Can you kind of conceive of the universe going on without you? Which, you know, I think I can. Obviously, it's like, when I die, I think my children's lives will go on. I want them to go on. I want the lives, and so I don't think the whole of society is going to end with the death of this one individual. And it's also sort of looking at your own life. Is it what you wanted? If it isn't what you wanted, you can kind of forgive yourself. We often talk about, you know, a good innings. We define ourselves by our deeds every day. We continue this becoming, the mystery of ourselves. But that is what it is to be human. And I suppose to accept that there is a kind of finitude in life, and that it's not going to be the end of the sun. Yeah, it's just going to be one planet amongst the whole galaxy of planets going round. And if you can, to be more accepting of that, that it's obviously our individual lives are the focus of us, but we can also see that we're also part of a society. You don't live forever. You do things, you know, have you got most of what you wanted? Even pop stars, Humphrey Bogart, they die too. People who we think of great sort of heroic characters, they all sort of die. Do they have everything that they wanted? One of my favourite films is Greta Garbo in Queen Christina. And, you know, it turned out it's a wonderful movie, and she's a sort of Swedish queen who meets her kind of Spanish lover, and who turned out to be her own former lover, actually, who's a very successful silent star. And that she goes around the room where they first meet for this liaison. It's kind of Swedish coaching in. And she sort of touches things. She says, oh, I want to touch everything to remember this room. And you think, and she got paid a huge amount of money for it, like at the time, made in 1937, $300,000, which is a fabulous sum of money. But it was almost like the last film she ever made. Her co-star, who she foisted onto the kind of production, then died of alcoholism. And so this beautiful, wonderful film, which exists, didn't lead to paradise for its two stars, you know. We kind of envy, we look at these lives and think, God, if only we can be like them. But when you look at their lives, it's, actually their lives are worse than our lives. And I suppose it's to try and train ourselves to be satisfied. You know, it sounds like a cliche, but satisfied with what you've got. You know, count your blessings, the things that you have achieved, the things that you've done well. We've all kind of missed out on a few things that we maybe think we should deserve or could have been, whatever. Even Greta Garbo, my God, and she was famous, and she was a great actor. You know, so rather than punish ourselves, I think it's to try and change it around, thinking, well, I've done these things. I've made the world a little bit better. Have I satisfied my life? Have I used this life that I have here in the best possible way? And to be sort of more accepting and less scared that this is going to be this cosmic oblivion. None of our deaths, even presidents, stars, in some way, like going back to this conversation, you know, thank God for death, otherwise Donald Trump would be ruling the universe forever.
One of the questions I often ask when I'm doing oral histories and talking to people who are dying is, especially with oral histories with people who are very elderly, and they're very much aware of their mortality. They know that time is very limited. And I say, is there something you'd like to say to your great-great-grandchildren? And the message is always, be kind, be decent, be a good person. That's all that matters.
Oh, no. I mean, we're only too sanctimonious. I don't want to diminish. Some of it is, life is a challenge. Sometimes it's about usurping of death. I would say seek, strive, eyes open with wonder. You know, there's a wonder in the world too. I was talking about, let's just say you take a Hawke's Bay apple from New Zealand, wonderfully sweet, but sort of mortal and perishable. And if you keep it for too long, it will rot and you'll lose it. Or else you could, you know, on those terrible flights from New Zealand into LA, and you arrive at LAX in some little box with all these guys outside, everyone with all these American security people with guns and some terrible American coffee. And then usually they provide these snow white, like almost fairy tale red apples that are, you know, the size of half your head. And they're there forever, you know, they never decay, but when you bite into them, they're completely tasteless. And that's the sort of alternative. The sweetness and joy of a Hawke's Bay apple that is only going to last for a certain season, or else some genetically manufactured plastic, you know, thing that tastes of nothing, but looks, you know, lovely. And so I'd say it's a very good very good metaphor. Which would you rather? I'd definitely rather the Hawke's Bay apple myself.
Can we talk about grief for a second?
Sure.
She doesn't want me to use her name, but her husband recently died, and she said, people keep on saying to me, there comes a point when you've just got to move on and just get on with it. And she said, it makes me very angry because she said, I don't want to move on. I don't want to stop grieving. I'm happy to grieve him.
Yeah. We all carry around a graveyard of our dead inside our heads. And we just carry it throughout our lives. And sometimes, you know, you spend a bit more time there. Sometimes it's a bit more intrusive. Sometimes, obviously, events happen and that brings back. Just the other day, I was talking about this friend that I'm still really angry with because of he kind of hid his death, George, and he had this sort of partner that was almost like a witch. And so the first time I knew that George was dead was literally when I was invited to his funeral. And as we were coming into the funeral, there was a female vicar outside and she was holding a box. It was like a kind of cigarette box, except the box contained George or George's ashes. Now, that's, I don't know, 10 years old. But I still can't. And it's kind of also examining why I felt really annoyed about why didn't he say, why didn't he share, why didn't he reach out? I would have loved to have known if I could have done something. The fact that I never knew that he was dying or had died was a shock. So I think you do carry your grief with you your whole life. It depends how, is it disabling? Is it somehow stopping you from doing something else? Is it preventing you? Is it negatively impacting upon your life in some way in the kind of present? And that's where, you know, it becomes problems. But we do carry grief with us, and there's nothing to be ashamed about carrying grief. What I think is that to be truly human is to carry the burden and joy of your own mortality and to strive in grace to help others carry theirs, sometimes lightly and sometimes courageously. And if you've lived as a human, you talked, Andrew, about the loss of your sister when you were young, that is what makes you human, the fact that we have had these losses, but we go on, that we don't kind of give up. We have to go on because there is no other choice. But we don't forget or expunge the memory and heart that these things can cause us.
Do you have a sister dying in Ireland?
Not at the moment. And I would have a view that would not necessarily be hugely popular with some elements here in New Zealand. I am not in favour of assisted dying, and a couple of reasons. One is that the fundamental law around homicide, having been a crime reporter, you know, homicide is a really old statute. Basically, it's killing of another human being. Now, assisted dying, whatever you want to say, is actually an act of homicide. Now, it might be a legal act of homicide, but it is an act of homicide. You know, when you, I think actually in English courts, you actually get charged with homicide, unlawful homicide, and then they decide whether it's murder or it's self-defense or there's provocation or there's diminished responsibility. But this is a fundamental tenet. So you're saying in certain situations, the state has got the right to license people to commit acts of homicide. Now, that's a big thing. Now we get on to this kind of circumstances. Some of the people who seek to promote the debate in the UK, and there is an ongoing parliamentary bill, it's just recently failed, but maybe it'll come back. The people who are most strongest advocates for assisted dying are often people of power, people who've been deferred to their entire existence, people who say, well, I want to be able to choose the moment of my death. I do find it hard to believe in practical terms that the Metropolitan Police in London are patrolling outside posh houses in Highgate and Hampstead, looking for the sort of TV presenters who possibly suspiciously may or may not have killed themselves or other people kill themselves. I find it pretty hard to believe that in a city with huge amounts of phone theft and lots of crime, that they're looking for these quite powerful people who say they do want to end their lives and they want to do it in this state, you know, sanctioned fashion. I mean, I find it odd to believe that these people, if they were so intent on that, they can't avail of that opportunity, sleeping pills, stuff like that. I don't think they should be, you know, prosecuted for that. So I find it odd that you want to then change the law of homicide, because what can affect the actions of these people who are powerful and at the top can have terrible consequences for people at the bottom who have never had those life choices, the disabled, the vulnerable, people put pressure upon. My own eldest daughter's disabled, and you know, you've had conversations with people about the quality of life and stuff like that. So you shift the debate around. It's not that this law will just affect people who have been able to choose all of their life. It will also affect people who've never been able to choose in their lives. Will it make them more vulnerable? I think it will. Will it add to the sum of human happiness? Will it give these people at the bottom more power, more protection? I don't think it will. I think it will give them less. And so it's really around, you have the legal consequences of this change, which everyone says, you know, well, I'm choosing for me, but you're a person. But if you're choosing for you, that's absolutely fine. But you're also, when you change the law, you are choosing for other people. And the consequences of that are, will still be very unclear in New Zealand. I mean, also people talk about, you know, the certainty of dying within 6 months. But, you know, if anyone familiar with, you know, medicine and palliative care, it's extremely difficult to obviously estimate when someone will or will not die within 6 months. And then now in Britain, there's one particular woman, Esther Ranson, who's a sort of TV presenter, who's, you know, quite a powerful woman. And she's kind of led a lot of this debate. Now, she's been dying of lung cancer for 4 years, yet she would be one of the proponents of this legislation. And she would often be interviewed on the BBC as a sort of advocate for assisted dying. But her own prognosis, clearly, is that she's lived far longer than sort of 6 months. So it's choosing for other people is the thing that makes me against assisted dying.
Kevin, I'm aware that you've got to get to a meeting in Raglan, and I would like to keep on asking you questions because this has been a fascinating discussion, but I better let you go, and I'd like to thank you very much for your time, and I've really appreciated everything you've had to say.
I'd just like to say one last thing to your listeners. Live long, prosper, and in a far distant galaxy, may you too find in death the grace that I found in my father's wake. Thank you very much for listening.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.